This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
This Macro Voices Premium Hot Topic podcast was produced on May 1st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Since this is our first Hot Topic podcast associated with the new Macro Voices Premium launch, I'll briefly explain the format. We'll be bringing you Hot Topic podcasts when an issue arises in the marketplace, which makes it suddenly relevant to speak to a particular guest who we might not have scheduled on the regular podcast. The whole idea is to bring you more timely, relevant content in addition to our regular podcast feature interviews, which are normally planned weeks in advance. Today's Hot Topic came about when Kyle Bass, the hedge fund manager best known for anticipating the subprime mortgage debacle, published his most recent investment letter. In that letter, Kyle Bass describes Hong Kong's diminishing role relative to both China and the global economy, and he goes on to predict that the Hong Kong dollar's peg to the U.S. dollar is not sustainable and is likely to eventually fail. ZeroHedge recently published that letter, elevating the level of attention it was already receiving from investors. We have a link to that ZeroHedge article in the description of this podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com if you're interested to read it. Now, to be sure, Kyle Bass is no amateur, and his words of warning about Hong Kong's foothold in the global financial system should be carefully considered by investors. But another finance veteran who's also anything but an amateur is Louis Vincent Gav, who runs GavCal, one of the most highly respected institutional investment advisors in the industry. GavCal is headquartered in Hong Kong, so needless to say, Louis' views on the matter are just as relevant to those of Kyle Bass. And in this case, despite being personal friends, those two experts don't seem to agree at all. So for today's Macro Voices Hot Topic, we're featuring Louis Vincent Gav's opposing views to those of his friend Kyle Bass. And just for the record, Mr. Bass has a standing invitation to come on Macro Voices if he wants to represent his side of the case more directly than having us quote from his investment letter. To date, he has so far declined our invitations. Listeners, Louis put together a slide deck which contains a number of graphs and charts which will very much help you to process and understand the discussion we're about to have. My strong advice is to download the chart book so you can reference it as you listen to the upcoming conversation. You can find the download link next to Louis's picture on the homepage at macrovoices.com. Louis, let's start with Kyle Bass's contention that Hong Kong's importance to China and the world is diminishing. Kyle Bass points out that post-2001, China has heavily invested in its own PRC port infrastructure and export economy, thereby greatly diminishing Hong Kong's role in the global economy and to China. So how would Hong Kong add value to China going forward now that they're building out all of their own infrastructure?
Look, I think Kyle is 100% right that Hong Kong in the future won't be the port that it was for China in the past. In fact, I don't need to project yourself in the future. It's already the case today. But I would say that on my side that Hong Kong's importance to China isn't really as a port. Building a port is, frankly, not that complicated. Yeah, it takes a lot of capital and it takes some years. But building physical infrastructure, I think China has proven over the past 20 years that they know how to do that very, very well. Hong Kong's importance to China is completely different. Hong Kong's main role for China is as a financial center. And here I would say that China has been very lucky, because the story of most emerging markets is you reach a certain level and you grow, and then you reach a certain level of growth. And to keep your growth going, you need access to a deep financial center. And building a deep financial center is not easy. It takes, frankly, generations. You need lawyers, accountants, bankers, brokers. It's a whole, I would say, soft infrastructure that you can't replicate overnight. And China was quite lucky because just at the time when in its growth it would need to start having a financial center, basically the Brits said, okay, it's 1997. We've spent the past 100 years building this financial center of Hong Kong, and here it is for you to take over. Don't mess it up. And so China is sort of in an unusual position in over the past 20 years, in that it is an emerging market. It is a developing market with a full-fledged functioning financial center. That's what makes Hong Kong special. It's not so much having a port. Yeah, having a port is nice, don't get me wrong. But that's not what makes Hong Kong special. What makes Hong Kong special is it's the third largest financial center in the world, and it really services an emerging market. It's a completely unusual combination, frankly, in the history of financial markets. And that role as Hong Kong as a financial center, to me, is not so much under threat, at least yet. You know, when I first moved to Hong Kong more than 20 years ago, the view back then was, oh, Hong Kong is dead. Shanghai is going to be the financial center of Asia, or at least of China, partly because that's the way the Chinese government was speaking. They were very adamant on pushing Shanghai as the financial center. But the reality is, still today, Hong Kong is the place to be. Today, the Hong Kong stock market is now bigger than the Tokyo stock market by market cap. That's just tremendous progress in just 20 years. And that reflects an underlying reality that Hong Kong remains the best place to live in Asia. And I often tell this to clients. I always say, look, if I came home and I told my wife, sweetheart, we're moving to Shanghai, she would say, no, you're moving to Shanghai and I'll see you on the weekends. Because Hong Kong offers a soft infrastructure in terms of schools, in terms of entertainment venues, in terms of clubs and whatever else that, again, takes generations to replicate. So I think narrowing Hong Kong's importance to China as just the port is very backwards looking and it's not forward looking. The importance of Hong Kong is not as a port. The importance is as a financial center.
Well, Louis, having just upgraded my Hong Kong ID card from temporary to permanent residency, I could not agree with you more. No, thank you. I couldn't agree with you more that it is the best place to live in Asia, right up until it's time to pay the rent. So let's talk about Hong Kong's property market, because post the great financial crisis, Hong Kong's property sector, it boomed given cheap debt, you know, as Hong Kong imported U.S. quantitative easing, basically. And there was double-digit credit growth from China. All these things propelled the Hong Kong property market to just staggering heights. But presumably, these factors are not going to remain in force in the future. And Kyle Bass is suggesting that Hong Kong's property market has probably peaked and is in for some really serious downside risk. Do you foresee a disastrous meltdown scenario in coming years in Hong Kong and the property market?
Look, Hong Kong real estate is undeniably crazy expensive. The prices here are simply just eye-watering, as you just highlighted. But there is a particularity to Hong Kong that I think we have to acknowledge. First, of course, is the limited supply. You know, if you live in New York City and you don't like the prices in Manhattan, you can go live in New Jersey, you can go live in Connecticut, you can go live on Long Island. You have options to move further and further away and just deal with the commute. In Hong Kong, you don't really have that option. So you have massive wealth creation, because it is growing rapidly as a financial center, taking place in a very constrained market. That's the first thing we have to acknowledge. The second thing we have to acknowledge is there is a tax arbitrage at work here, in that, you know, if you live in Hong Kong, you pay 16% income tax. If you live in China, you pay 30. So if you're a rich Chinese guy, let's say, who has factories somewhere on the mainland, you have an inherent desire at some point to likely move to Hong Kong. The way I would build up the analogy is, imagine if Manhattan, which arguably is one of the funnest places to live in the United States, with booming cultural activities and some of the best schools in the country and whatever else. Imagine if the tax rate in Manhattan was half the tax rate of the rest of the United States. What would be the clearing price for Manhattan property? It'd most likely be a whole lot higher than it is today, right? It'd be probably crazy high, because you'd have every rich American wanting to move to Manhattan, if only to benefit from this tax wedge. So yes, Hong Kong property prices are crazy, but there's some fundamental reasons behind why they are crazy. And then you get to the question as to what the catalyst is going to be to see this rollover in real estate prices. Now, I want to say one thing before I get there. I want to say that I agree completely with Cal's premise that to see a bust in the Hong Kong dollar peg, you need to see first a bust in real estate. for me, it's a complete necessary, but I would say it's also a non-sufficient condition for the bust in the peg. Without a meltdown in Hong Kong real estate, I don't think the peg can really blow up. So I can understand why Cal decides to focus on the Hong Kong real estate market and the contradictions within that market. But when I say it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, it's necessary but not sufficient because we've seen many times Hong Kong real estate prices kick it on the chin, and that didn't mean that the peg broke up. So if you look at between 1997 and 2003, when every Asian currency was devaluing aggressively, over that time, Hong Kong real estate prices fell by 70%. And that's 70, not 17, 70%. You've seldom seen such a crash in real estate prices anywhere in the world. And this crash occurred without the failure of any single Hong Kong commercial bank. Can you imagine another market anywhere in the world that would see a 70% drop in real estate prices and you wouldn't see a banking crisis? Yet this is what we saw in Hong Kong. Now, it doesn't mean that the next time Hong Kong real estate prices tank, it'll all go as smoothly. But we have to acknowledge that falling Hong Kong real estate prices do not de facto mean that the peg blows up. Now, then you get to the question of, are Hong Kong real estate prices about to tank? And, you know, yes, they are expensive, no doubt. So you have to be cautious on them. But are they about to tank? For me, the big question is, what would be the catalyst? Would it be higher interest rates? I struggle to see how Hong Kong interest rates are going to shoot up, especially now that the Fed has basically turned around and is sounding all sorts of dovish. And I struggle to see how Hong Kong real estates are going to tank when the Chinese policymakers have basically done the same. You know, 3 years ago, the discourse in China was all about cracking down on shadow banking. It was all about cracking down on corruption. It was all about cracking down on, in essence, funding of the Chinese private sector. And this completely changed in December of this year when Yi Gong, the PBOC governor, came out and said, hey, actually, there is a role for shadow banking in a well-functioning economy. In essence, just like the Fed changed its stripe at the beginning of 2019, the PBOC and the Chinese policymakers also changed their stripes at the end of 2018. So in an environment of easier Fed and easier Chinese policymakers, is this really the backdrop for a big drop in Hong Kong real estate prices? I don't think so. And in fact, what you've witnessed in the past couple months is not only the volume of transactions have been picking up, but prices in Hong Kong have been also rebounding quite aggressively. So, you know, if you look at the policy backdrop, it's like, I can understand why you'd be worried about Hong Kong real estate, but the policy backdrop tells me that right now is not the timing for a drop in real estate prices, quite the opposite. And in fact, they are starting to move higher. So I question the timing.
Louis, I want to come back to the currency peg in just a minute, but let's start by moving on to the banking sector. Kyle Bass has argued that because Hong Kong's banking sector is probably one of the most levered in the world at about 850% of GDP, Hong Kong is particularly vulnerable to economic downturns. And specifically, Kyle Bass has suggested that HSBC and Standard Chartered could need to be bailed out by the Chinese government, which would have profound implications. Do you think that's likely to happen?
Look, I struggle a little with this argument for many different reasons. I think that the first reason I struggle a little bit with it is I've always been somewhat uncomfortable with arguments based on debt to GDP ratios. Because for me, you know, debt to GDP ratio, you're comparing a stock to a flow. And, you know, I'm not sure whether such a ratio can tell you much. You know, if you go back to the days when everybody was arguing that we should short JGBs and that, you know, government debt in Japan was unsustainable and JGB yields were going to shoot up and that shorting JGBs was the easiest trade. These, and of course, as we know, that was it ended up being called the Widowmaker. These arguments were also best based on debt to GDP ratio. For me, it makes more sense to look at, if you want to go down this path, to look at stock versus stock. So you look at debt versus assets, or liability versus liability, i.e. cost of servicing the debt versus GDP. So, and this is especially true, I would say, in the low interest rate world in which we inhabit today. you know, the reason the debt to GDP ratios never worked for Japan, and I think the reasons they're also not going to work for Hong Kong, is we do live in a world where interest rates are very, very low. So in essence, it becomes a circular argument where you say, hey, look, the debt to GDP ratio is very high. So if the cost of servicing the debt goes through the roof, then we'll have a problem. But the problem is it doesn't, because the debt to GDP ratio is so high that it really prevents any meaningful pickup in interest rates. And frankly, just staying with this idea, I go one step further. Does looking at the debt to GDP ratio for a financial center like Hong Kong really make that much inherent sense? I mean, if I go down this path, what you'd want to do to compare apples with apples is say, okay, let's look at the Manhattan debt to GDP ratio, or let's look at the London debt to GDP ratio rather than the UK or the US one. And my guess is if we did that, and I haven't done it because I don't know where I'd get the data, but if we look at the Manhattan debt to GDP ratio, my guess is it would blow out Hong Kong's many times over. So, you know, the idea that you look at Hong Kong because you have the data, but you kind of make abstraction of the fact that it is a financial center. It's the financial center that services a massive economy at the back end. So, you know, just like you could say, well, looking at Manhattan debt to GDP wouldn't make sense because really a lot of the debt that goes on in Manhattan goes out to service businesses in Wisconsin or Minnesota or wherever else. The same really could be said of Hong Kong. And so, you know, I look at this and it makes me somewhat uncomfortable. Now, when it comes to, you know, the issue you raise on HSBC and Standard Chartered, I think they really don't play in the same league. And, you know, HSBC is, of course, one of the most globally significant banks. It's one of the few banks out there that has a market cap of over $150 billion. It's also one of the few banks, frankly, that has managed to sort of keep a share price more or less steady for the past decade or two. Standard Chartered has always been more of a roller coaster ride. It's much smaller. And Standard Chartered really is only important, I would say, in poor countries. The old joke in Asia is HSBC banks in countries where you can drink the water and Standard Chartered banks in countries where you can't drink the water. And so, you know, if there was a problem, I would say, you know, HSBC would be a whale that could conceptually impact not just Hong Kong, but would, of course, impact the whole world. And so if there was a problem, and I personally don't believe there is, and I'll come back to that in a second, but if there was a problem, I think they'd be bailed first by the British government. After all, both of these are British banks with British headquarters and significant businesses in Britain as well. So if they did need a bailout, my guess is that the first in the line of fire would actually be the UK government and the Bank of England. So if you think there's a structural problem with HSBC or Standard Chartered, you might first want to look at shorting the pound rather than shorting the Hong Kong dollars. But I personally don't think there's going to be problems with either of these institutions. And I say this as a guy who's got, you know, his personal account and his business's accounts at HSBC. And, you know, for the 20 years that I've banked there, I feel like all I've had to deal with have been tight-fisted Scots. Most of the time, I find it's hard enough getting my own money out of HSBC, but getting a loan or getting somebody else's money, it's downright impossible. So I look at this whole issue, and I think, look, when it comes to banking crises, I think what the past, you know, 50 years of banking crises have shown us is that what matters is banking crisis isn't so much the liabilities and the size of these liabilities, but most importantly, how these liabilities are funded. 2008 showed us that over-levered banks that depend on money markets to fund the liabilities are very dangerous places because money markets can decide from one day to the next to just not fund you anymore. Banks that depend overwhelmingly on massive amounts of deposits, meanwhile, are very stable. This is why in 2008 and again in 2012, you know, French banks like Crédit Agricole or BNP kept the show on the road when others blew up because they did have massive amounts of deposits. I like to say this, but and it's not very politically correct, but most people change spouses more often than they change banks. And this in spite of the fact that no spouse, however bad a marriage gets, would ever dream of treating you as bad as HSBC treats some of its customers. So, you know, I look at this and I think, hey, for HSBC, which a bank that basically has what is it, 60% of Hong Kong people have their deposits at HSBC. I think that's pretty safe funding. And it looks to me like a lot of other banks would go bust before HSBC does.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that from personal experience. You know, you've got to have, I think it's a million Hong Kong dollars just to get an HSBC premium account, which entitles you to being treated only slightly worse than a normal retail bank treats its customers everywhere else in the world. And you are supposed to feel privileged because you are HSBC Premier. And they do, in fairness, in Hong Kong, they allow you in all of the HSBC offices to sit down if you are Premier. You have to remain standing while you wait if you're not Premier. So seating is provided for only at the million Hong Kong dollars and up level. Anyway, let's come back to the Hong Kong U.S. dollar peg, which you mentioned earlier. Kyle Bass has argued that that peg is untenable given the growing lack of synchronicity between U.S. and Hong Kong economies. In addition, Kyle Bass believes that the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, in his estimation, has been burning through its foreign reserves to support the peg over the last couple of years, and he worries that Hong Kong could wind up, let's say, like Thailand in the Asian financial crisis, where they're unable to defend the currency. What is the likelihood, Louis, of that happening in Hong Kong?
So look, here, I have to say that as a firm, we've been always very quick to blame any fixed exchange rate as the cause of economic distortions or financial calamities and marital problems and bad sporting results. You know, by and large, we've looked at fixed exchange rates and said they create distortions that create just economic disasters. And so I have some sympathy for Carl's argument at the get-go. Having said that, as a firm, we've also been historically, and we remain today, very undisturbed by the Hong Kong dollar peg. So you could say, okay, you know, how do you match the sort of attitude of being against fixed exchange rates and being, you know, not worried about the peg? And the reality is, I go back to a very famous French economist called Jacques Rueff, and he said, the exchange rate is a spigot through which distributed but unpaid for rights get cashed in. And the idea is, you know, if you've got government policies that make no sense, if you've got workers that are lazy or are paid not to work or whatever else, then over time, your exchange rate will tend to go down. And here, you know, I come back to the point that Cal makes is, yes, there is, you know, if you project yourself forward and you think, okay, Hong Kong economy and U.S. economy are going to go different directions, how can the peg stay? But here for me, if you want to go into that long-term question, I think the first place you start to look, of course, is fiscal policies. You know, who has the long-term fiscal policy that makes more sense? Is it Hong Kong or is it the U.S.? Well, since 2003, Hong Kong has not run a single year of budget deficit. Since 2003, the U.S. has not run a single year of budget surplus. So if you project yourself and, you know, just looking at the IMF projections, this should continue for the next decade. Over the next decade, the U.S. will continue to run budget deficits of anywhere from 3 to 5% of GDP. That assumes no recession. When Hong Kong will continue to run budget surpluses of between 1 and 2% of GDP. So if you're worried about the distortions between the two economies, really, where should you be worried? Should you be worried about U.S. dollar weakness, or should you be worried about Hong Kong dollar weakness? Looking at fiscal policy, for me, the answer is the divergence in fiscal policy. For me, the answer is pretty clear. Now, going one step further, and I think that goes hand in hand with a fiscal policy that in Hong Kong basically ensures that if people don't work, they don't get paid, while in most Western countries, of course, we have fairly generous welfare states, you move to worker productivity. And that, of course, as everyone knows, is where, for example, the euro is breaking down. In Europe, you have Germany that has a very high productivity of workers. You have, let's say, Italy that has a lower productivity per worker. Ergo, the only solutions available is either Italians have to move to Germany or the cost of labor has to go down in Italy in order to be competitive with the Germans. And that makes it, of course, very tough socially and almost impossible in countries with a fairly generous welfare state, because people will just refuse to work for lower wages. This isn't, of course, how Hong Kong functions. Hong Kong is first and foremost an immigrant society. Most people in Hong Kong are either first, second, or third generation immigrants, and there is no welfare state. And so, you know, I mentioned it before, 97 to 2003, Hong Kong, in order to save the peg, adjusted through deflation. You saw Hong Kong real estate prices drop 70% and Hong Kong labor costs drop 30%. You might remember this from 2003, but in 2003, the Hong Kong cab drivers, the taxi drivers, went on strike because they wanted to have the right to lower their prices, because the prices are mandated by the government for cabs. And they wanted to lower their prices so as to boost their volumes, i.e. a typical capitalist reaction. People weren't riding the cabs because they didn't have enough money, i.e. so we got to lower our prices. The government refused it because they were worried that people wouldn't take the bus anymore. In what other country in the world would you see a trade association of any trade of the taxi drivers lobbying the government to cut their prices? For me, this symbolizes what Hong Kong really is about. But staying on this difference in productivity, Hong Kong adjusted between 97 and 2003 through deflation. But since then, if you look at the productivity of workers in Hong Kong relative to the productivity of workers in the U.S., Hong Kong productivity has massively outstripped U.S. productivity. So with unsustainable fiscal policies in the U.S., with workers less productive, to me, it's not obvious that what we need to worry about is Hong Kong dollar weakness out of this peg. If anything, if I project myself forward and I look at the trend of recent years, I'd be more worried about the U.S. dollar. And that brings me to another point, and I'm sorry I'm being long-winded. But the general mood in the market today is to look for who's got the big short dollar position out there. And I understand, you know, we've had 10 years of very low interest rates. It's likely that people have borrowed too many dollars, et cetera. So, you know, the mood is who's got the short dollar position. But for me, the most obvious one with a short dollar position is A, the U.S. government, already running a $22 trillion debt and budget deficits for as far as the eye can see. But more importantly, the U.S. pension funds, U.S. municipalities, U.S. states, whose unfunded pension and medical liabilities could be running in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. Those are the guys who are naturally short the U.S. dollar. Now, of course, you could tell me, yeah, okay, fine. Yep, these guys are short U.S. dollar in massive amounts. But all that debt is going to end up being monetized. So we shouldn't worry too much about it. The Fed will step in, print a bunch, and we'll work through these unfunded liability issues. And I agree with that. I agree that deep down, what's going to happen when you look at this enormous amount of unfunded liabilities in the U.S. is that the Fed will print to help the government and the pension funds roll everything forward. But that leads to an environment of a world awash with U.S. dollars as all this debt is monetized, not a world that is short U.S. dollars. So again, you know, you look at the fundamental trends of where the debt is today, and I'm a whole lot more worried personally about the debt situation in the U.S. and the unfunded liabilities there than I am of, say, Hong Kong.
Louis, a final point that Kyle brings up is extradition law. He's suggesting that the new Hong Kong extradition law, if passed, would be the final nail in the coffin on the one country, two systems doctrine, and that that might cause the United States to terminate its 1992 U.S. Hong Kong Policy Act, which basically allows it to treat Hong Kong separately from the Chinese government in foreign relations. So first of all, for the benefit of listeners who are not Hong Kong residents, as you and I both are, what are we talking about here? What is the new Hong Kong extradition law? And then what do you think about Kyle's analysis of how it might lead to the U.S. dropping its separate treatment policy?
So the extradition law is a very contentious issue in Hong Kong right now. And just last weekend, there were tens of thousands of people protesting in the streets. So what listeners have to realize is that Hong Kong, under the one country, two system that was put in place following the 1997 handover from Britain to China, Hong Kong maintains its own police force. It maintains its own justice system. It obviously maintains its own currency. So it's in essence, its own little legal entity, even if it is part of China. You know, by treaty, basically China is responsible for defense and foreign affairs for Hong Kong, and everything else depends on Hong Kong. Now, the extradition law would basically see that any Chinese person that happens to be in Hong Kong and the Chinese government tells the Hong Kong government, okay, you got to send these guys back to us, the Hong Kong government would basically have to do it, which would be a profound shift. Because let's say you were a dissident in the past or even a corrupt tycoon or whatever else. In the past, if you made it to Hong Kong, you were basically, well, maybe not 100% safe. Well, if you were a dissident, you were definitely 100% safe because they would never have sent back a dissident. But if you were a corrupt tycoon, you'd still have to go through all the Hong Kong courts before they'd send you back. And, you know, they'd have to prove their case, et cetera. So, your case would be tried in a Hong Kong court rather than a Chinese court. So this extradition law would be a profound shift in the Hong Kong judicial system, which is why people are showing up on the streets to protest against it. And there's no doubt that this extradition law inscribes itself into a pattern that we've seen now, really since Xi Jinping's arrival at power, of frankly deteriorating civil rights, definitely in the mainland, and sometimes even a little bit in Hong Kong. That is deeply worrying. I think if you look at China, you know, over the past 25 years or 30 years, it was easy to say, well, obviously it's not a democracy. Obviously people don't have all the same rights that we have in the Western world, but the sense of trajectory was broadly positive. You know, for years and years, it felt like, yes, China's starting from a much lower base than where we stand today, but it's going in the right direction. And so, you know, with that, you could feel decently encouraged. You'd say, all right, you know, the path of travel is positive. Today, it's not obvious that it's actually fairly obvious that you can't say that anymore. And so that is indeed deeply worrying. Just as, frankly, you know, the killing of the Yellow Umbrella Movement leaders a couple weeks ago was also a little bit of a cold shower. So I take Cal's concern on this, and I think it inscribes itself into a broader discussion of what is Xi Jinping trying to do here. Because, again, up until Xi Jinping arrived, it felt as if the path of travel was towards more civil rights, more deregulation, more freedom. But now it's not obvious that this is the path of travel. So that's for the Hong Kong part of the equation. For the U.S. part of the equation, in Cal's argument, I would say he's obviously much more of a specialist on U.S. politics than I am. And I'm not going to claim that I know how the U.S. would respond to this extradition law passing. Having said that, I'd be quite surprised if the U.S. terminated the 1992 U.S. Hong Kong Policy Act on the back of this. I'd be surprised for a number of reasons. The first is, you know, the U.S. policy towards China right now is really focused on getting a great and preferably beautiful trade deal with China. So amidst all of this trade negotiations, does the U.S. really want to get involved in a matter of Hong Kong domestic policy and to see the trade talks potentially fall over on the back of Hong Kong domestic policy? Seems unlikely to me. Second reason, frankly, is, you know, Hong Kong, as we discussed earlier, is a financial hub. It's a service hub. It's a very important platform for a number of U.S. banks, U.S. insurance companies, U.S. law firms. So does the U.S. really want to undermine its own companies in this very important center? And for what gain? You know, if the U.S. basically turned its back on the 1992 Act, you'd have a lot of U.S. companies that would suffer a lot. And what would concretely would the U.S. gain out of this? Now, you know, when I look at President Trump, when I look at Mike Pompeo, they don't strike me as guys who take stands on just because of the moral high ground. They're deal makers. They're real politic guys. They're not going to trade an advantageous position for U.S. companies for nothing on the other side. And, you know, I tend to think that if the U.S. was inclined to terminate the act because of the extradition law, then the U.S. would likely pass that message on to both the Hong Kong and the Chinese government. They do it quietly. I mean, that's what you have diplomats for. And this would then give both the Hong Kong and Chinese governments the opportunity to shift policy or even perhaps shelve the extradition act. But the fact that Hong Kong and China are powering ahead and that the U.S. is staying quiet about it, frankly, leads me to believe that, you know, for the U.S., this isn't really a battle they want to pick. So, you know, I put it all together. I hope I'm wrong, but I fear the extradition act will happen. But frankly, the U.S., it'll be like water off a duck's back for the U.S. They won't really care. It's just not their fight.
Listeners, I just want to remind you that there is a chart deck that you can download that accompanies all of the information that Louis has described. So please, if you're not already perusing those charts as you're listening, follow the download link, which we told you at the beginning of this interview where to find. And I think you'll find those charts very interesting. Louis, I can't thank you enough for dropping everything on short notice to record this Hot Topic interview with us. I really look forward to having you back soon as one of our new Macro Voices All-Stars guests. And listeners, you can expect us to respond to hot topics in the marketplace by promptly reaching out to the right people, such as Louis in this case, for timely current perspective on the biggest issues of the day in global markets. Please send us your suggestions and requests for hot topics that you think we should cover. We can't respond to all your emails and tweets, but we do read every single one, and we will consider listener input when choosing future hot topics and hot topic guests. For Macro Voices Premium, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.